can go and separate because nobody can separate. To write it off. Only when I speak.
Right, excuse me. You've got to leave. Who says I will allow you to leave at 12? Put it in writing, and it has to. It was supposed to have reached my office 12 hours before the meeting. So, it's not a problem. But good morning, honourable members. Staff of the department, TDG, DGs, directors, and from the Department of Mineral Resources, as well as PMG and media. As it is the custom of our committee, that we normally introduce ourselves. But let me take this word of welcome to one of the new members of Parliament, Honourable Lee. He's an old member, don't worry. He's nearly second hand now of Parliament, part of the furniture. But Mashambane, good morning to you also, and welcome. But to Honourable Abrams, I'm not sure if it's Abrams or Abrams, but in Cape Town we call you Abrams, in Gauteng they call you Abrams, but Abrams is fine, that's the Cape language, that's the Cape slang. Welcome, man, and we hope that we're going to have a very fruitful and successful working relationship. You must just ask your colleagues next to you. We are very progressive in this committee. We differ from each other, but the one always pushes the point through, and that's the one sitting next to you on your left hand side. But to all our other members, my co-chair, Honorable Dumisani Kamede from Trade and International Relations, welcome, sir. And it's good to see you all in one piece again, and I hope you are refreshed, recharged, and refueled after the recess. Also, welcome to Honorable Sinclair and Kenneth Sinclair, and I hope you are also refueled and refreshed and recharged. Honorable Sinclair, wonderful. To all members, Honorable Gunda, Honorable Nyambi, as well as Alhoshi, Honorable Dikhali, and as well as Honorable Van Lingen. To the staff of Parliament, we also want to welcome our researcher that has joined us, Lwazi Mslangu. He has joined us from DTI. We are full-fledged staff complement, our secretary, Ms. Tina Zulu, and everybody. But my name is Freddie Adams, and welcome to everybody present here, PMG, media, or whoever from whichever organization you are, welcome. Feel free, relax, to everyone, relax. We won't slaughter you. We won't do anything unnasty. We won't be nasty. Just relax. Relax and engage. And feel comfortable. Parliament media as well. Feel comfortable. And welcome to you guys as well. Ms. Molefe and your colleague. It's nice to have you and to see you in our committee. My name is Freddie Adams. I'm a permanent delegate from the Western Cape. And I'm also the chair of the Economic development, Select Committee on Economic Development. If I can start with on my left, we go down, we start with Mashambane.
Elf Lees, or Mazamban, as commonly known, from KZN, thank you.
Jomo Nyambi from Mpumalanga Province.
John Gunda from the Northern Cape.
Beth Abrams from Gauteng.
Elsa van Lingen from the Eastern Cape. Masifa Godekhale from Limpopo.
Thompson Tamete from KwaZulu-Natal.
Kenneth Sinclair, Northern Cape.
Andre Andreas, Mineral Resources.
Dokozo Nqabe, Mineral Resources.
Good morning, sir. Honorable members, Musa Mabuza, Mineral Resources.
Okay. Justin from Idasa.
Azul from PNG.
Johanna, PNG.
Richard Davis from SA Press Association.
Rod Maslang, Parliament Research.
My name is Vito Mesela from Committee Section.
Now that's everybody knows everybody, so that we don't hear tomorrow that we have learned from reliable sources, we can put the name to the story and to the minutes that PMG is writing and all that. Madam, introduce yourself, please. Welcome, Uswa. Welcome, everybody. DDG and your team. Very welcome to the briefing. Just before we go over to the briefing, members, on the agenda, on announcements, we just need to put down the oversight visit program, which will start tomorrow afternoon. So let us just put that on the agenda, please, so that we as members can discuss that. DDG, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. None of us here are DDGs, though. We must apologize. Our DG asked us to tender an apology for him. He is in Parliament. There is another proceeding where he is presenting the annual report, and our DDG is also at that meeting. So they asked us to apologize for them. We are, however, the team that is responsible for legislation and the charter, as well as the rehabilitation of derelict and ownerless mines. I will be doing that presentation on the derelict and ownerless mines, and my colleague Musa on my left will be doing the presentation on the charter and the charter review process. And I would like to then hand over to him, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honourable Lees.
Mr. Chairman, do we accept the apologies from both the DG and the DDG who have chosen to go to another meeting? Is that acceptable?
Well, let me apologise first off. I should have given the committee a background. What happened is that the Portfolio Committee are busy with the BRR process, with the Budget Review of Parliament process. And in terms of Treasury, they have to finish that by this week. And the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee has then consulted me and requested, if possible, we can allow the DG, the CFO, and the DDG for them, for the portfolio committee to process the budget review process, excuse me, on Milner Resources. And after consultation with the secretary, and then I said, yes, if they sent me the competent team that deals with this. And so I apologize, committee, for not informing you, but I took the discretion that the team is quite competent and able, and that's why I have said, yes, it is fine. So, okay, thanks, Honorable Lise. But also, on the other hand, the DG is supposed to report to the president today as well. So, so he's doing there, and then he's running off to report. Okay, that's good. No, it's fine. Is that acceptable, committee? The apology is acceptable from the DG and DDG? Thank you. Thank you very much. You see, we're progressive here.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Sorry. Just also the apology of the Minister, because the Minister also have to report to the President with the DG today on the department's plan and program of action. The President has called them and they have to report what are they doing and those type of things. I don't think they're going to discuss nationalization, but they just have to go and report the progress report. So the apology also for the Minister as well.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We'll leave that topic to the experts. Honorable members, it's a great honor for me to... there we go. To deliver this presentation to the Honorable Committee members on the progress on the mining charter. The outline, briefly, we try and place the mining charter in the regulatory reform context, and we look at the impact of the mining regulatory reform the framework on the
Mabuza,
and the economy.
Sorry to disturb you. Are you sure you're at the right committee in representing this? Because I see that you said your presentation to the Parliamentary Select Committee on Finance. Now, I don't think that we have changed names of this committee, or we have changed membership, or maybe it's an oversight or a slip of the finger, because a lot of fingers have slipped here on that.
My humble apologies, Honorable Chair and members. That's an oversight on my part.
Members, do you accept that apology? Good?
Thank you.
Are you sure? All right. Now, you see, in politics, you've learned to cover yourself. Because tomorrow the TA can't say, or COPE can't say, but no, we were never consulted on the name change of the committee, sir. So just to cover myself, I was just asking that. But everybody's in agreement.
And I'm a member of both.
And you're a member of both, both committees. Thank you, Mr. Mamabuza.
Thank you very much, Chair. we'll briefly look at the impact of the mining regulatory reform on the mining industry and look at those elements in terms of the previous mining rights structure, what employment has been in the industry prior and post the reform. We'll briefly look at investments and a couple of economic indices. And then we'll get to an assessment report of the charter and look at what impact it has had. And then we'll take you through the amended charter. And then we'll conclude. Just briefly on the mining charter, it is a mining stakeholder negotiated document. You may recall when this document was leaked in 2002, the country lost in excess of 52 billion rands within 48 hours of the charter being leaked.
and it was expeditiously concluded within weeks of the leak and adopted as a document that will effect transformation. It is established in terms of Section 100 of the Principal Mining Act, the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002. I must emphasize the next point, that the Mining Charter is the first sector instrument to effect transformation. And so, if honorable members can appreciate that at the time of adopting this charter, there was never a predecessor of charters, and so we were effectively venturing into unchartered territories. The
sorry, Mr. Magusa, I just got a question. One member, honorable Sinclair.
Chair, I just got a question of clarity. I see this document is strictly confidential. Now, I don't know if the status of the document has subsequently changed, because with due respect, it seems that this is an open meeting.
Well, okay, Mr. Mabuza, explain,
please. Thank you, Chair. I used a template of a strictly confidential document. You would notice in the presentation that it has been removed. So the document that is before you is not classified, sir.
Well, this is an open meeting. We don't want to exclude SAPA or anyone from here. So feel free. It's just an error there. Slip of a finger. Not a slip of a tongue this time. Sorry? Yeah. Okay. But it is acceptable, honorable Sinclair. The apologies that were given.
No, it seems that we've become a society of apologists, you know. All that we do is we apologize.
I was asking if you accepted. It's either yes or no.
Yes, but I don't apologize for that.
No, thank you, Honorable Sinclair. You can carry on, Mr. Novus.
Thank you very much, sir. The objectives of the charter, as it was adopted at the time, had six main core elements: to promote equitable access to the nation's mineral wealth. It sought to substantially and meaningfully expand opportunities for historically disadvantaged South African to benefit from the exploitation of the nation's mineral resources, to utilize the then existing skills base to empower historically disadvantaged South Africans. It sought to expand the skill base beyond what existed at the time. It sought to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of mining communities. And mining communities included both host community and major labor sending areas, and to promote beneficiation. The elements of the charter were identified as follows: the ownership element, the human resources development, employment equity, mine community development, housing and living conditions, beneficiation, procurement, and reporting. Just looking at the mineral rights structure before and after the MPRDA. Before the MPRDA and the mining charter, mineral rights were vested in the main in private hands, and this in the main thwarted the potential for investment. It became almost impossible to locate some of the lucrative mineral rights in the country, among other things. And so what the MPRDA brought to the fore was, among other things, was to vest the custodianship of mineral rights in the hands of state, And as you would see later in the presentation, this unlocked the inherent potential for mineral development. The reformed regulatory framework enabled diversification of mineral commodities that are mined and the related socio-economic impact. We've put in brackets there from depleting gold resources. We will demonstrate what the impact of gold had been. There have been more than 26,000 applications that have been received in the department since the promulgation of the MPRDA. And this, we believe, that is the demonstrates that there had been and there continues to be a mineral rush in South Africa. Just in terms of employment in the graph before you, you would notice that since, I think it's 1986, it's much better here. Since 1986, that's when the gold production started to decline, exactly in 1986. And because gold constituted over 80% of, represented over 80% of the mineral industry in terms of employment and revenue that the country earned. As gold production declined in 1986, so did employment in the mining industry. And you'd notice that by 1986-87, the employment in the industry peaked beyond 800,000 at that time. And it systematically declined until around 2001, where it started peaking again, coinciding, among other things, with the regulatory reform, but also coinciding with the commodity boom, the longest commodity boom that started in 2002 in the world. The next graph shows what the gross fixed capital formation in the mining industry has been in real terms. But we deliberately peaked from 1998, and the significance of 1998 is that the white paper on mining policy was adopted in 1998. And you would notice that moving from 1998 to 1999, there was a very small decline in investment. And that decline can indeed be ascribed to uncertainties that are brought about by the new regulatory framework. It is not unexpected that when you introduce a new changes in the regulatory environment, that it does bring about some uncertainty. So you would notice that there has been a very small decline from 1998 to 1999. In 2004, the MPRDA came into force. And you'll notice there is a substantial decline from 2003 to 2005. And there have been many reports that that significant decline in investment has been as a result of the new regulatory environment in South Africa. Well, it doesn't make sense to us because the MPRDA is effectively the enunciation of the policy environment. So there is nothing that was introduced in 2004 that the mining industry did not know already, because we were elaborating with the MPRDA on the white paper. There are many other elements, attributes of that significant decline in the investment. And you would recall that one of them is that the rand substantially weakened in 2001 and it continued to strengthen leading up to 2004-2005. And we are pleasantly surprised as a department that there has been a single focus on the regulatory environment, and that the regulatory reform was entirely attributed to that significant decline in investment. But just to demonstrate the point further, we broke the investment growth and averaged it in the period before 2004. You see, between 1998 and 2003, the average growth in investments, it averaged 7.4%, and post 2004 leading up to 2008, it almost tripled on average, growing at 17.9%, almost 18%. Well, our mineral growth export sales have been growing steadily as well over the years. Certainly in the period 2000-2001 all the way to 2008, that phenomenal growth that you see there in exports could largely be attributed to it coincided with the longest synchronized commodity boom in the world. In the next graph, we show the mining as a percentage of GDP. Over the period, you would notice that it averaged just over 8%. But in real terms, the mining GDP has been growing from just over 50 billion in 2000 to almost 200 billion rands in 2008. So there's been real growth in the mining industry. While this indicator is an economic indicator, simply shows the spread of the wealth, you can see that from 1998 to 2008, there has been a steady growth in terms of the GDP per capita in the country. And this growth between 1998 and 2003, it averaged 9.1%, and between 2004 and 2008, it averaged 11%. And this data comes from Statistics South Africa. However, the real measure of the distribution of economic growth of the economy to the people of South Africa using this, the Gini coefficient is an area of concern in that South Africa has become the most unequal society in the world in terms of income disparities by class, by gender, and by race. And this happens at the time when the GDP per capita is growing steadily year on year. And that suggests that there are fundamental structural challenges in our economy as a society, and that growth is not distributed effectively where it should be, addressing the real issues that face the country. We'll get to the next point of the presentation, which focuses on the what has the Charter achieved since it was adopted in 2004. Firstly, we look at the methodology. As a department, we looked at the records that are resident within the department, and we compared that with the records that are resident at the various mining companies. We sent out questionnaires to source that information, and we procured the services of an external consultant to assist us with all of this process, and undertook a detailed analysis of this data. But I must say that the interrogation of the data, the external services' work was to collect the data for the department. The processing of the data was concluded within the department. We selected what we believe is a statistical representation of the mining companies, from large companies to through mid junior to mid-tier companies, and we also looked at small companies, and our analysis also was spread across all the 9 provinces in the country. What we then did was to look at the Charter of 2002 as it stood, and so all these questionnaires and the interrogation of the data effectively related to the charter as it stood and looked at how we have progressed on that charter. The current, the measure of the original charter, you know, we just extracted it as it were. Has the mining company achieved HDSA participation in terms of ownership for equity or attributable units of production of 15% in historically disadvantaged hands in 2009, which is the first part within 5 years? Well, what did we find? We then found that the ownership in terms of, this was the most difficult of the lot because we looked at ownership as a total transaction. And we looked at that against the value of mining in 2009 in South Africa and then worked out the percentage. And that came to around 8.9%, which falls short of that big red line at 15%. That was the target. But now, when you look at that 8.9% and you interrogate it further, it is not necessarily the 8.9% that is in the hands of historically disadvantaged South Africans. This is the value of BEE transactions. In there, the significant part of that 8.9% is that is locked in the cumbersome financial structuring that affects these BEE transactions. It's locked in the cost, the weighted average cost of capital that financial institutions impose on BEE transactions. It's locked in the legal costs that BEEs have to carry the burden of. It's also locked in the management costs that affect those BEE transactions. But we also found that on the net, almost 25 there is a lockup of 25% in the upside potential of a project, which is also included in the cost, which we would have averaged as 8.9%. And the cumbersome structuring, among other things, is that the BEEs were not allowed to have any cash flows coming to them as business people. They are paid using dividends from the operations. 100% of dividends flows into paying the debt that they would have inherited from the transaction. And even if a portion of the debt has been paid, in one specific case, we had a BEE who has paid back 54% of the original debt. They could not use that 54% that is paid out to, you know, to leverage equity so that they can grow. So you can then see that this BEE, as we have put it up, is really not benefiting the people that we have intended that it should benefit. If there are any real beneficiaries from these BEEs, the financial institutions, is the legal firms, and the mining advisors. And so this was a bit difficult to calculate, but it is our belief, given the many BEEs that have gone under in the past 2 years, that if you look at what the net asset value in the hands of BEEs, we believe that they are far worse than where they were before they entered into these BEE transactions. And so there is a negative value that they have accrued in the process, and that cannot be correct. Well, the next one we looked at was the human resources development. You would see the measures, we've also extracted these measures as they stand. I mean, we appreciate that this is a knowledge-based industry, yet when you look at the measures that we have put out at the time, they're not really talking to what we were seeking to achieve.
Has the company offered every employee the opportunity to be functionally literate and numerate by year 2005? Has the company implemented career paths of HDSA employees, including skills development plans? Has the company developed systems through which empowered groups can be mentored? Well, what did we find? We then found that in terms of functional literacy, only 17% of companies achieved the 2005 target of functional literacy and numeracy. And also in terms, it is the same companies, 17% of the mining companies, that had developed career pathing mechanisms. And it was also an insignificant 11% of companies that engaged actively in the mentoring of empowering groups. So 89% of companies just never got involved in assisting the BEE companies in mentoring them in this industry. We then looked at employment equity, again extracted the measures as they stood. The first part of the measure requires the publishing of the employment equity plan and the annual reporting on the progress in meeting that plan. The second part is requires the company to establish a plan to achieve a target for HDSA participation in management of 40% within the first 5 years and its implementing plan. The next part is whether the company has identified the talent pool and is in fact tracking this talent pool. And the last one is, has the company established a plan to achieve the target for women participating in mining of 10% within 5 years, and that was the 2009. Well, what did we find? We found that in terms of achievement of the 40% threshold representation of HDSA in management, 26% of companies, mining companies, achieve that target. You'd notice that it's linked to the next one, which is the 10% participation of women in mining. So it's the same companies, effectively. But that 40% is problematic, because what we then found is that even though this 26% has attained the 40% threshold, because white women are classified as historically disadvantaged South Africans, then the mining companies tend to give preference to white women, number one. Number two is that the broadness and the vagueness of this measure then allowed for companies to report on junior management positions. So you then find that a large chunk of historically disadvantaged people other than white women are limited to junior positions, and that is also lumped in there as part of the 40% threshold. And then the third part is that there is very limited representation of historically disadvantaged people in the core and critical skills that underpin the sustainable growth and transformation of this mining industry. And we also found that to be problematic, in that we cannot transform this industry if black people's jobs is to be HR and government liaison officers, executives. So the same argument then applies under the 10% participation of women in mining. And in terms of identification of skills and tracking those skills within the organization, you'd notice that the mining industry, 17% of the companies had effectively concluded that process only of identification. And it's not linking rationally to the achievement of the threshold that are reported. Moving to the next element of mine community and rural development, the measures stood as follows. Has the company cooperated in the formulation of IDPs, and is the company cooperating with government in the implementation of these plans for communities where mining takes place and for major labor sending areas? And the second one is, has there been an effort on the side of the company to engage local mine community and labor sending area communities? companies were then required to cite a pattern of consultation and indicate the monetary commitment and expenditure and show their plans. Well, what we then found is the following, and this is now beginning to look better, that in terms of the consultation requirements, you know, 63% of companies have effectively consulted. However, the quality of the consultation is questionable. If the tensions between communities and mining companies that are emerging are anything to go by, it's an indication for us, it's a symptom of poor quality consultation, that in the main, the extent of consultation is not as good as it should be. The IDP, Integrated Development as a measure, just under 50% of companies have participated and developed projects under the auspices of integrated development plans. And now the real concern is that only 14% of the companies have participated in IDPs for labor, major labor sending areas. In terms of the housing and living conditions, 17 years into democracy, we're still talking about housing and living conditions. The measure here was for company to provide housing, and the question that was asked in the measure is, has the mine, in consultation with stakeholders, established measures for improving the standard of housing, including the upgrading of hostels, conversions of hostels to family unit, and promoted home ownership schemes for mine employees. It went further, this measure, to say companies will be required to indicate what they have done to improve housing and show a plan to progress the issue over time in the implementation of this plan. The second measure required the companies to provide nutrition, and the measure is the mine established measures for improving the nutrition of mine employees, and companies will be required to indicate what they have done to improve this nutrition and show a plan to progress the plan over time and its implementation plan. And this is what we have found in terms of these measures. You would notice that it's also a fairly disappointing progress in the first five years of the charter. But the way we must read this is that not all companies provide hostels, and that is why some of the percentages look lower, and that some of the elements are mutually exclusive. So if you, for example, upgrading hostels, all of them, you don't necessarily have to convert them to family units, or you can do both. And so some of the figures, as low as they may seem here, they've got to be read in that context, that some of the elements are necessarily mutually exclusive. But in the main, we found that 26% of mining companies provided housing, 29% improved the existing housing infrastructure of their employees. In the main, most companies have moved towards home ownership participation. And honorable members, I just need to elaborate a little bit on this one. You'll notice that the communities surrounding mines are characterized by proliferation of shacks, of illegal dwellings, precisely because you would then find that this home ownership that is advanced, you know, people are given 500-600 rands as a home ownership option, and I think you know better that you would not be in any position to buy any decent house with a 600-700 rand ownership housing subsidy. And so they then tend to settle in the illegal dwellings. And that's why you see most of the mines are characterized by this feature. 29% had nutritional plans established, and the upgrading of existing hostels remained at the low figure of 9%. We found that there is still, on average, although it has moved down from an average of 16 men occupying a single room, it has moved down to an average of 4. But that is still totally unacceptable in terms of the dignity of the mine employees. And the conversion of hostels to family unit is sitting at a very low 6%. In terms of procurement, the measures were applying as follows. As the mining company, given historically disadvantaged companies, preferred supplier status. The next one is, as the mining company identified current levels of procurement from HDSA companies in terms of capital goods, consumables, and services. And the next one online is, as the mining company indicated commitment to a progression of procurement from HDSA company over a period of 3 to 5 year time frames in terms of those categories, and to what extent has these commitments been implemented? And the answer to that is in the next slide, in that in the reports that we received, we found that there is 37% of mining companies had HDSA participation in procurement. And only 11% of them have developed mechanisms that will provide for HDSA preferred supplier status. And 20% of them had committed to progressing the procurement of these goods and services from HDSA within a value of 3 to 5%. Now, having a 37% of companies that procure goods from HDSA companies, what do we find to be the value of procurement from HDSA companies? It's 3%. Why is it 3%? It's because HDSA companies are used for cleaning, for, you know, those peripheral support services and so on, and that is not sustainable, period. On the issue of beneficiation, the question here is, has the mining company identified its current level of beneficiation? Has the mining company established its baseline level of beneficiation and indicated the extent that this will have to be grown in order to qualify for offsets? Now, in this particular area of beneficiation, there is still work being done. The beneficiation strategy has been finalized within the department. We have had to extend the window of consultations up to a few weeks ago, and we are now at the stage of taking the beneficiation strategy to cabinet within this financial year. And so this measure, we unfortunately could not measure how much progress has been made because there is still that gap on our part. And then in terms of reporting, the measure is, from the charter is adopted, the companies undertook to report on an annual basis as per the provision of Section 28(2)(c) and Section 29 of the MPRDA. And the measure there is that as a company reported on an annual basis, its progress towards achieving its commitments to the mining charter. And what we have found is that 37% of companies reported to have audited reports on mining charter progress, but these were never submitted to the department. 11% of companies have submitted their reports to the department. And this is an area where we as a department as well had a problem, a challenge in terms of the capacity within the department. In that the processing of these reports, the receipt and coordination and the systems that would allow us to process this data were not in place. And we have moved towards creating that capacity within the department to enable us to receive this data on an annual basis and be able to process it on an annual basis henceforth. And so, on the basis of that progress, honorable members, that you have seen, this is summarized, there is a report that we shall make available to honorable members on a report that details this presentation I've just shared with you. One of the major findings we have made out of the report, other than the progress that we've just articulated, is that the construct of the charter was problematic. The identification of the elements was proper, and it sought to address the correct issues. But when you look at those measures that we have put out, they are not really talking to what we are seeking to achieve. And that, in the main, then created ambiguities, which ambiguities then created space for multiplicity of interpretation of the charter. And so in our process of reviewing the charter, we then found out that the elements that we identified remain relevant in addressing the transformation issues. But I must also emphasize that the process of amending the charter is located within a bigger approach that the department has adopted together with its mining stakeholders, and namely the Chamber of Mines, the South African Mineral Development Association, SAMDA, the National Union of Mine Workers, NUM, Solidarity, and UASA. At the implosion of the financial crisis in 2008, the department led the establishment of a task team, abbreviated as MIGDET, Mining Industries Growth, Development and Employment Task Team. And this task team had a two-pronged mandate. The first mandate was to mitigate against the vagaries of the economic crisis, and the second part was to position to recommend interventions that are sought to position the mining industry along a growth trajectory when the upswing returns. And in its work, MIGDET recognized that in the past, the growth of the industry and transformation were viewed as mutually exclusive. And so stakeholders agreed that henceforth, we must develop the mechanisms that will emphasize the mutually reinforcing nature of growth and transformation, because it would not be helpful for us to transform an industry that is dying or to have an industry that is growing but not transforming, because that would also not be sustainable. And so under the auspices of MIGDET, two task teams were established, one on competitiveness and the other on transformation. And this amendment of the mining charter is effectively based on the work of the tripartite, all of the members of the tripartite, under the task team of transformation. And I think I need to emphasize that it is indeed the work of all stakeholders. And we then agreed with stakeholders that we needed to strengthen the charter. We agreed that the elements were in the main proper, although we did introduce a new element given the approach that I've just articulated. We needed to strengthen and sharpen the effectiveness of the charter so that it can drive both transformation and competitiveness in the mining industry. So we then improved the construct of the language. We introduced a scorecard. The original scorecard had a yes or a no in the reporting. And so the scorecard we have introduced attaches weightings so that one can score themselves and see how they are doing, and removes the ambiguities. As I indicated, the amended charter retains all the original elements and introduces a new element on sustainable development. I will touch on that a bit later. And the last point is the one that I just alluded to. What have we done in terms of ownership, given the challenges that we have faced and articulated earlier on? You may recall that in 2002, the department committed that it will not shift the goalpost. And so the target of 26% ownership by 2014 is retained in the amended charter. It emphasizes on meaningful BEE participation and describes what is meaningful BEE ownership and participation. Number one, it emphasizes that there shall be no mining right issued on a BEE partnership that is not constructed with the following: the entrepreneur, employees, and communities. And so this one emphasizes the point of, in the previous one, there were a handful of beneficiaries from BEE transaction, and we needed to broaden that scope to ensure that communities and workers do benefit. And also we do elaborate further on the meaningful BEE participation to take care of the cash flows and the ability of BEEs to be able to leverage from their vested assets. And it also introduces the evaluation of the financing structure, and all of those details are in the review charter, in the definition of a meaningful BEE ownership. And so we've also allowed to offset. The only offset that is allowed against ownership is on beneficiation, purely because beneficiation allows the growth of the economy. It allows other economic activities and presents opportunities for additional employment. On procurement and enterprise development, instead of asking whether the company has preferred BEE supplier status, it sets out specific targets here and requires, and these are progressive targets, which when you look at the scorecard, it shows how they progress from 2010 to 2014. But ultimately, the minimum 40% of capital goods must be procured from BEE entities, 70% of services by 2014, and 50% of consumer goods by 2014. But in addition, we've recognized that the bulk of the capital goods are procured from multinationals operating in South Africa who are not contributing to social development. And so it introduces a requirement for 0.5% of their annual income towards a social fund, which social fund would be used along the lines of social and labor plans. In terms of employment equity, honorable members, you'd recall that I presented the challenge in terms of lumping all the HDSA, and this charter says it retains again the 40% target by 2014, but then it outlines the various categories of participation of HDSAs, as you see them outlined, from junior management all the way to executive management, and all of them have to be at 40%. And this graph is sourced from Mining Qualifications Authority, MQA, and it just demonstrates the occupational distribution in the mining sector overall. 85% are Africans, 12% are white, 0.4 Asians, and 2.1 colors. The point of this is that you would then expect that the employment across the occupational levels, categories within the mining industry, should emulate the demographic spread in South Africa, because the employment in the mining sector, as you can see it, fairly resembles the demographics of the country. The next one is on human resources development. And here stakeholders have committed to invest a percentage of their annual payroll in the skills development with emphasis on the demographics of the country. You would notice that by this year they've committed to spend 3%. I must say that the annual payroll in the mining industry is 60 billion rands currently. And so the commitment of 3%, ramping up from 3% this year to 5% of that payroll by 2014, with an anticipation of growth in the industry, is not insignificant. And it will begin to address the challenges of skills that the industry continues to grapple with.
Sorry, Mr. Honorable Kunda.
Sorry, Chair. Can you just, what you just said now, just go slow on that. I want to understand you very clearly. What are you saying about this 3.3% to 5%? Just explain to me. Does that include every level of the mining? Of the employment in the mines?
Yes,
sir. Just explain it again, please. Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question on that later on.
Sure. What this element introduces is a requirement for every mining company to invest those percentages in skills development of their payroll. And that is ramping up from the 3% this year of their payroll, and you can see the increases as we move down to 5% of their payroll by 2014. So every year they will invest a percentage of their payroll in skills development. And in the scorecard, we then go and outline the specific areas of the investment in skills development that will begin to address the challenge of the shortages of skills that the industry is plagued with.
Order. Relax, Honorable Kunda. You'll get a chance to answer questions. Carry on, Mr. Mabuza.
Just to demonstrate the quantum of the problem, and Honorable Members, I'll refer you back to the employment equity statistics and the distribution of employment in the mining sector. The source of this data is Statistics South Africa, and it demonstrates the number of graduation by race only in 2007 and 2008 in all engineering fields. What is of a concern is that, you know, we continue to have, if you look at the bachelor's graduates in 2007, 145 black, 640 white, 50 colored, and 34 Indians. If you work that in the percentage, it's a reverse of the demographics of the country. And therefore, we, you know, with what we are trying to address with the management representation and skills development is to begin to increase as well the number of historically disadvantaged South Africans who should be trained in the core and critical skills in the mining industry. You'd see those numbers are appalling, absolutely appalling. While there has been an increase, marginal increase from 2007 to 2008, in any of the categories you look at, less than 10% of increment from 2007 to 2008. Without these engineering skills, we cannot grow this industry sustainably as a country. And then in terms of the mine community development, I'm happy to report that in this charter, stakeholders have agreed to adhere to international best practice and guidelines. And one of them is that the investment in, it's the next point, in ethnographic community consultative and collaborative processes ought to be proportionate to the investment in the project. For example, you would find that there are companies that invest 10 billion rands in project development and they spend 5,000 rands in a community project. That is not proportionate and that is not sustainable. And so that's what we have agreed there. And that they would conduct assessments in the communities to determine developmental needs in collaboration with the mine communities. And that's what they will demonstrate to us. And they will identify projects that will contribute towards meaningful community development in line with their integrated development plans that is proportionate to their investments. That's the point I made earlier. And in terms of the housing and living conditions, honorable members, I'm happy to report that in this charter we have agreed with the stakeholders that companies would implement those measures to improve standards of housing and living conditions for mine workers as follows. That where applicable, they will convert and or upgrade hostels into family units by 2014. And that they will the occupancy rate of one person per room will be attained by 2014. And that they would also, in addition to that, facilitate home ownership by miners in consultation with organized labor. And this is a new element that we have introduced, honorable members. It is the one on sustainable development and growth in the mining industry. And mining companies are required in terms of this charter to implement elements of sustainable development commitments that are outlined in the stakeholder declaration. And this is a document that was signed by stakeholders on the 30th of June of this year. In that document, all stakeholders committed to improve on environmental management, which my colleague would be talking to later on, and to also improve on the health and safety performance of this industry. And lastly, to utilize South African-based facilities for analysis of samples in the mining industry. And in terms of beneficiation, this is an element that, in terms of this charter, we will introduce this measure from 2012 so that we can conclude the processes within the department, within government, of adopting beneficiation as policy and outlining what the requirements are. And almost finally, in terms of reporting, monitoring and evaluation, we have developed a detailed scorecard which this new charter introduces with specific weighting allocated for each of the elements of the charter as well as its sub-element. The reporting is provided for in terms of Section 28(2)(c) and Section 29 of the MPRDA. And this reporting requirement, as outlined in the scorecard, it really provides for a qualitative and quantitative assessment of the progress we are making on an annual basis. And mechanisms to effectively deal with non-compliance are provided for in terms of Section 99 of the MPRDA, the penalties that are there, and Section 47 in terms of suspension and cancellation of the right. In conclusion, I just needed to emphasize that this mining charter is a precursor of all sectoral charters. If you look at them, all of them are premised on the identical elements that were originally introduced by the mining charter. The extent of transformation of this sector in the first 5 years is unfortunately inadequate. However, the construct of this charter of 2002 as a negotiated and compromised document did present grey areas in the elements and the measures of the scorecard, and it had unintended consequences of exploitation and multiple interpretations. The lack of capacity within the DMR, then DME, also compromised the extent of vigilance on the implementation of the charter. The charter focused on transformation alone, and there was lack of focus on the sustainable transformation and growth of the sector, and this is the previous charter. The industry regarded the charter only as a compliance mechanism, not as a business imperative. In the first 5 years. And we as policymakers also presume that everyone is committed to transformation. We've learned that that is not necessarily the case. The amended charter strengthens the construct of the language in order to obviate against any multiplicity of interpretation or any inherent ambiguities. And this amended charter introduces an element of sustainable development, and it also introduces a scorecard with clearly defined targets. Reporting mechanisms are well defined on an annual basis, and the current review of the MPRDA, among other things, is to beef up the penalties on the provisions that may be imposed on companies that are non-compliant. Honorable members, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mabuza. I think we can, for the sake of interest and progress, carry on to the next presentation because it still falls under number one. Progress of the rehabilitation of derelict and ownerless mines. Alvagunda?
Yes, sorry to interrupt, but having the next briefing again, some of us will be leaving this meeting by 5 to 12 o'clock. We will never have the opportunity to ask the questions that we really need to ask. And we will never have received the answer that we really need to understand. So having the next briefing for another 30 minutes will never give us the opportunity to ask any single question or any clarity.
Well, unfortunately, to understand the whole process, we need the next briefing also. That is the progress on the charter, the mining charter, which is still work in progress. This is now the ownerless and derelict mines, which were the number one item, or supposed to be the number one item on the agenda, because that is what the Portfolio Committee are busy doing now with the BRR process. In these mines are lying out there, and the report that was issued or published out was very negative. And I think we should take the briefing and then take the questions. If needs be, we will call the department back. If we can't finish, we'll call them back and we'll just do our work properly then. Thanks, Mr. Mabuza.
Okay, just one observation we've made, Chair, on the comment you made that the charter work is still work in progress. We forgot to mention that the charter has been finalized and has been gazetted. So the process has been concluded. Okay, moving on to the progress on derelict and ownerless mines. A presentation outline, again, will refresh the memories of the members of this committee and just briefly look at the definition and the history, really, of this legacy that we are dealing with, and then move on to the database that we have compiled of derelict and ownerless mines, the process in terms of prioritization, the assessment of the financial impact, and look at selected sites that have been rehabilitated, and then move on to a very topical issue of late, that one of acid mine drainage. We've opted to include that in our presentation because it is very much related or linked to the DNO mines. And then look at what our implementation plan is on the strategy that we have come up with for derelict and ownerless mines, and then we'll move on to concluding remarks. Just on the history, honorable members, we thought we would look at, because this helps us to contextualize the issue of derelict and ownerless mines. Where does it come from and how has it come about that the state is faced with this epic challenge? Going as far back as 1903, there was never proper legislation that made it a requirement for mining companies to look after the environment as they mine, let alone rehabilitate at the end of their mining activities. So companies would just mine and off they go and leave whatever mess behind them. 1931 to 1951, with the mines, works and machinery regulations, then some minimum distances to structures was introduced, and this is what we see in today's Mine Health and Safety Act, which is still not, which still didn't address really the issue of looking after the environment. And some basic planning then came about with the Mines and Works Act of 1956. And the real environmental management structure or proposal only came about with the Minerals Act of 1991, and it was strengthened a little bit with the MPRDA in 2004. By way of definition, when we say, because we have seen that derelict and ownerless mines are often confused with just abandoned mines, which are not necessarily ownerless. So derelict and ownerless mines, really, it's mines where owners are not operating nor maintaining them, but cannot be traced. And these are the ones where the state then has to take liability. But in cases where owners are found, we are very much determined to enforce the law. And to date, just in the East Rand alone, we have managed to trace about 100 owners of abandoned shafts. And we know that this is going to be a difficult one, because in law, there is nothing that empowers the state to take them to task. But we are saying we are not just going to let that go by. We are going to engage with this. In fact, the process has started in terms of engaging these companies for them to take liability. Just briefly looking at what environmental impacts we are looking at that are related to derelict and ownerless mines. Obviously, there are health and safety issues, surface water pollution as well as groundwater pollution, and that is where the issue of acid mine drainage comes in, air pollution and damage to sensitive environments, impact on current and future land use, and the impact on heritage resources. I'm sure honorable members are aware of the one other topical issue of mining in that Mapungubwe area, which we are also dealing with as the department, together with the Department of Environmental Affairs. Just again, briefly looking at the measures taken to address the impact to date, the last time we presented to this committee, we did say that we have developed a database on derelict and ownerless mines, and we had commenced a process of prioritization and ranking. We have moved on to do an assessment of the financial requirements. At that point, we announced a figure, an estimated figure of about 30 billion rands that the state would require to resolve all the challenges presented by the derelict and ownerless sites that we have mapped and are on our database, but also the implementation of the actual rehab work has commenced. Just on the database, to date we have a total of about 6,152 entries. These are the sites that we have that are derelict and ownerless. And the way we compiled this, we identified, we looked at different mineral deposits, we did verification with DMR regional offices, and we did some field verifications and ranking visits in some of the sites. But I must say, with the site visits, we have encountered some challenges here and there, where some of the sites are not easily accessible by car. For example, you would have old maps and mine plans from our mine survey unit that here there is definitely a shaft or an abandoned gold mine. But when you go for a field verification, you find that it's difficult to access that site. So that alone presents its own challenges in terms of saying, what measures are we going to put in place now for us to be able to access those sites? And that talks to pushing the costs up even more. We've compiled data from other sources. we've done extensive research on mining that has happened throughout, but also new applications for either prospecting or mining that we receive in the department render the database dynamic, and it means that we need to continuously update the database. For example, sometime last month, we went out to 4 sites in Mpumalanga for field verification, and those were entries in our database of DNO. But we found when we went there, we first went to our regional office and then took the plans, the latest plans they have on those sites. And then we found that some people have been granted prospecting rights on those properties. And that automatically then renders that no longer derelict and ownerless, because it now has a new owner who has acquired the right to work on that. So our database then is dynamic. We would need then to come back and update our database to say this is now no longer on the list of ownerless abandoned mines, but has an owner, which is now because it's now an active mine. And we are currently looking at possibilities of making that easy for ourselves, where we won't necessarily need to go out on site to do that verification. The system we have, where we capture and process and manage new applications, the National Promotion Mining System, the NMPS for short, when we receive an application, we capture, it comes with a coordinated sketch plan or layout plan, and we capture those coordinates into the system. So what we're looking at, and then it would give you a polygon with the property description to say this is Farm Lang Lachte in Mpumalanga or whatever. Now what we are trying to do is we want to take the database that we have of derelict and ownerless mines and overlay that data on the NMPS, which is the system where we accept and capture our applications, so that as and when an application is received by the department, the system automatically then tells you that this site falls within the list of derelict and ownerless mines, and then you are able to update it there and there to say, put a flag on it, so that when this right is granted to somebody, then you take it off the list of derelict and ownerless mines. I must say, though, that it's going to be a very challenging and time-consuming and costly exercise, because the coordinates we have on the derelict and ownerless mines are not really compatible with the GW84 that we use on our NMPS system. But that is an exercise that we said, let's look at it and see how feasible it is and how far we can go with it. But secondly, it's going to also have cost implications on the department to work towards attaining that. We will try, though, to, in fact, the intention is to try and incorporate it within the system as we are upgrading the overall system, mineral management system of the department. So within that plan, we want to factor this in. But obviously, it is going to have cost implications, and it is going to take a bit of time. But also, I must say, Chairperson and Honourable Members, that this is for the first time in the history of South Africa that such a comprehensive database has been developed. And this really provides a detailed record of derelict and ownerless mines in South Africa, thus allowing us to have a systematic way of managing the problems that we are faced with. On the grouping and prioritization, we looked at sites according to their commodities and expected environmental impacts. For example, you know the impacts that are associated with gold mining, that with gold mining areas you are expecting impact on water resources, that is your acid mine drainage, and the same goes for coal, and you know with other commodities that with this commodity these are the impacts. But we also did grouping according to provinces and the scale of the rehabilitation that would be required. For example, if you would find a hard rock quarry, you know it's within this scale and it would roughly cost X amount of money to rehabilitate that. And you know that the impacts are in the region of this, based on the nature of the quarry and the minimal impacts that a quarry presents, other than visual impacts and safety issues if it is close to a community. Sites which pose immediate threat to communities have also been prioritized. Asbestos, as we have always said, asbestos is a priority, and hence work on asbestos will never stop. However, we prioritize work with the limited resources we have. Work on asbestos sites will never stop. But we've also said, let's prioritize open shafts and trenches in the Gauteng region, particularly in the Wits Gold Basin. Just an example of how we have done the prioritization. We've looked at, let me first explain this. We've had a project which we started in 2007 where we said we want to look, have a specific project that's targeted on just abandoned shafts and trenches where you don't deal with maybe a big open cast mine, but just looking at shafts. Because we were saying those open shafts that are left or abandoned like that also contribute to the water issues that we have. Because during rainy seasons with the heavy rains, the amount of water that ingresses into the underground workings through those abandoned shafts is unbelievable. So we looked at shafts in Wits, in Gauteng, Northwest and Limpopo. And we discovered about 900 abandoned shafts. So we said when we now prioritize, we would prioritize the open shafts, and we are happy to say to date about 108 shafts just in Gauteng alone have been filled properly. We have some pictures of that. We will show those as we move along with the presentation. So we said we will prioritize the shafts in Limpopo as well as the asbestos sites, as we indicated that asbestos is still top priority. Gauteng, again, shafts. KwaZulu-Natal, we left a space there. We have identified one project that is within a community there, Osizweni, which is a coal and clay mining site. Lusikisiki Quarry in the Eastern Cape, as well as some sites in the Northern Cape. But as we do the field verification, we've also said to ourselves, we need to, because we have 6,152 sites, and for us to decide which ones do we start with, where do we start, and how do we really start implementing the program with the limited resources that we have, because really the resources are very limited, but we'll talk to that later on as well. We had to say, firstly, it's these ones, sites that pose high risk on the environment, but also sites that pose high risks on the human element and health and safety particularly. So we said we need then to go further as we do the field verification and identify sites that are within communities or sites that are close to communities. So basically this exercise is meant to ramp up the data that we have in our database, because in the database you just have a number of sites. But now to say what impacts does each site pose on the environment as well as the health and safety aspect, we need to ramp it up in terms of saying this poses a high risk on the environment, but it also poses a high risk on the health and safety element. So what we've done, we've taken some data from the Department of Water Affairs, and we're looking at how do we overlay that data over the on the database that we have of derelicts and ownerless mines, because the data that Water Affairs has, they were using that for their own water supply program. So that would indicate where the communities are. So if you take that and overlay it over our database, you will be able to pick up that here there is a community, and within that 1 kilometer or 10 kilometer distance, there is a mine or an abandoned mine. We have done that just for testing and piloting purposes, and indeed we could identify a few asbestos sites in the Mafefe area in Limpopo, and already we are putting plans in place to commence work in the area of Mafefe. Further on ranking, I mean, I've spoken to how we are going to prioritize. To date, we have managed to rank and physically visit 85 sites. But this will be really looking at the number that we are working with, I mean, over 6,000. It's a process that will take about 5 years, depending on the availability of funds. But again, we are saying we are not going to just sit and relax and say we don't have funds. We are going to work hard and mobilize even National Treasury to ensure that we get the requisite funding. We've also done some assessment of the financial impacts, and the desktop is a desktop approach that we used, which assumes that all mines will be rehabilitated by the state, all of them in the database. But also we used the financial guideline, financial provision guideline that we have as the department. And at that point, a figure of 30 billion was arrived at. But as indicated, this figure is not static. It has to be reviewed on a regular basis, taking into account the costs that go up on an annual basis, as well as also the inflation that also influence the costs. Again, it quantifying the liability of the state in this regard is not an easy exercise. Cost of rehabilitation would vary. There is really no simple model. Because you find that if you look at that Osizweni, which is one of the sites really that we have started working on for implementation, it's huge. But it has a very minimal impact on the environment. But rather, it's rather a health and safety concern from the community perspective. Because if you look there, you can see that there are houses, there are people living there. And as we visit the site, really the shortest distance there between the pit and somebody's house is like 4 meters, literally 4 meters. So that's a lot of work will have to be done there, but it doesn't, it's what I was saying, that looking at some kind of a matrix, it's not an environmental, a major environmental concern, but it is rather a high risk on the human factor. Others will require basic rehabilitation just for safety, to satisfy the safety requirements. But in some cases, some specialized rehabilitation would be suggested. For example, the installation of bed grates in shafts in conservation areas, where we've even done some research to say, how are other countries doing? You know, we are continuing with that. We are doing some benchmarking exercise, and we find that for this, you would spend per shaft, you'd spend something like maybe 20,000 rands, as opposed to the ceiling of a shaft, which costs us in the region of 200,000 to 300,000 per shaft. And it also is about the end land use, because there can only be three options. You rehabilitate, at the end, the site could be used for, could be for economic use, could be for recreational use, or it could be for tourism purposes. So in conservation areas, for example, with this case study, it was found that there were a lot of birds there, and for conservation purposes and other birds, et cetera, it made sense, economic sense, to rather do that as opposed to sealing the shaft altogether. So that's a very involved process that we've got to do that. When we start implementing the program, you look at a site individually to say first what could be the best end land use here, and then you work backwards from that identified end land use. Rehabilitation to date, we've done 48 sites, mainly in the Northern Cape and Limpopo, and all of those are asbestos because asbestos was banned and we had to prioritize asbestos. But on the abandoned trenches and shafts, we have sealed 108 in the East Rand area, but also some general maintenance of derelict and ownerless lime dams in Gauteng, in maintaining the grass and preventing runoff and maintaining the gabion structures, etc., has been ongoing. And that we find that this often isn't counted as part of rehabilitation when it is, and a lot of money goes into that, and to date a lot of money has gone into it. On coal mines, TNDB, prevention of access to that dangerous coal mine, that was also partly or partially rehabilitated, and a full rehabilitation plan has been developed, and it has been costed at just over 100 million rands to implement. And if I may just share with the committee, we are talking just one site, and yet we get on an annual basis about 50 million rands from National Treasury. So if one site costs over 100 million and you get less than half of that from National Treasury, I'm sure members can already start calculating how long then it would cost us to rehabilitate the 6,000 sites. The last time we were here, honorable members, we did say that there were sites that we were currently working on implementing together with MinTech, and we are happy to report today that all those four sites have been rehabilitated to completion. This is just an example. One site, Strelly, we started working on this one at the end of January, and this is how it looked like when we did our first site visit. And after, as somewhere in mid-July, this is how it looked like. And by the end of July, when they really completed the work, it looked different with grass starting to grow. And there's another second site, Jobolo, also in the Northern Cape. This is how it looked with the asbestos dump. You can see there's some asbestos just exposed. And afterwards, this is how it looks. But also members would note we have put some employment figures there, even though, because we are saying with the rehabilitation program that we are implementing, we're looking at both short-term and some long-term employment that would come out of it. So with Strelly, 42 jobs were short-term jobs were created, and with Jobolo, 14 jobs were created. Priska, also an asbestos old mill site in Northern Cape, this is how it looked before. 37 jobs were created, and this was a site visit we did in July, and that's how it was. You could see some work done there. And what we do when we do rehabilitation, we also engage with municipalities and communities in those areas. And in this case, we worked with the municipality in the area. And they've taken a decision, the municipality, that once the rehabilitation work has been completed by DMR, they need then to take it further and develop the site as a memorial park for victims of asbestos, and that work is currently underway. But from DMR site, we had completed our work as at 30th of July. One last project which we had spoken about, which was the fifth project that we had MinTech to implement for us, could not be completed, and it's only being implemented now because of the inflation. By the time they were ready, firstly, when that tender was advertised, it came out too high from the initial projections that we had done. And in terms of the Procurement Framework Act, it says if a tender comes in too high from the expected or the projected figures, it must be cancelled. So in terms of that, we had to cancel that, and MinTech had to redo it. But then when they redid it, there was that shortfall then on the amount, and then we had to wait for Treasury to authorize that. so that we could then transfer the money to MINTEC for them to implement the project. But that has been done, and the money has been transferred to MINTEC, and MINTEC has started to implement that project, and that project will be completed by the end of January 2011. Just an indication of these trenches and shafts that we've been working on in the East Rand. That picture was taken with that little boy. He was walking home from school. You can see that there is a residential area there, and these kids walk past here every day. And just looking at it from the surface, it looks like not a major thing. But it really is, because this is like 1,000 meters deep. So if this boy was to fall in there, that would just be the end of him. So that's how dangerous this is. That is why we decided we would prioritize that also in our implementation program. Again, this is just an indication of the distribution of all the abandoned shafts that we have identified in just in the Vets Basin. And that's your western basin, that's the central basin, and this is the eastern basin. And you can see the concentration in terms of where is what. But also the pictures at the bottom indicate really, you know, in shafts like this, you would find that some time ago some of them were sealed. But because there is still material in them, you find that they are vandalized because people are looking for scrap metal. And then they leave it like that, which then poses a major challenge to the community. But we have come up with a technology to do it such that it would not be attractive to anyone to go there and vandalize them. That's what we have done. We seal them with concrete, no steel material in the concrete plug, so that no one would go there for scrap metal. And once we have filled a shaft, we then put that big, heavy 2.5-ton concrete block written that there is a shaft here. We do this for two reasons. One, to alert the communities who live nearby, because even here you can see there are people who live there, which is like less than a kilometer from the shaft. So that we alert the residents that there is a shaft here. But secondly, what we then do is we register these as servitudes against title deeds. And we do this really so that even for future landowners, if someone buys this land, they already know that there is a shaft here, and therefore there is a risk of subsidence at a later stage or anything that's related. So that land is not suitable. We do like a 100 by 100 meter servitude so that they know that that is not safe for erecting any permanent buildings. Public awareness, we don't leave that out. There was a question that came up earlier on. In communities where we go and do the rehabilitation work, we do public awareness, and this is one of the pamphlets that we did when we did the program in the East Rand, where it was written in English and translated into Tswana and isiZulu so that communities could relate to it, and we distribute this even to school children. Now, moving on, Chairperson, to real-time issues, we thought we would also touch on that, particularly on the issue of acid mine drainage, just to say what is the department doing about it and where we are with it. The objectives of this program, because since 2003, the department has undertaken some targeted research on strategic water management in the Vets area. And the objective was to ensure that we prevent the ingress of surface water into underground mine voids. And one of the solutions we have come up with to address that is the construction of canals in some of the areas, the establishment and recommendation of management solutions, where we are saying what are the solutions that can be implemented in the different areas to address some of these challenges. But also we have been able to say we needed to predict where and when the decant would occur, should pumping operations cease. We also needed to predict the effects on the environment and the health risks that are associated with that, and development of management options to say how do we manage these challenges. Just looking at what we have achieved to date on the prevention of ingress of surface water and groundwater into underground mine voids, we have been able to date through that research program to identify the multiple ingress points in the Vest Basin. As a result, we have started to say a solution to that would be the construction, for example, of a canal, and the one that we have started is the Florida Canal, which is currently under construction. And that canal is merely diverting water away from the ingress points, channeling it into the Florida Lake, and then it avoids it going into underground workings. What remains to be done, short-term actions to limit ingress, like cleaning of culverts in the blast box. We've identified both, you know, immediate solutions that can be implemented immediately with less costs, but also saying in the medium to long term, what is it that we need to do? And that's the costly, that's where a lot of the costly work would go. Verification of other ingress areas and proposal of solutions, that work is currently underway. Construction of ingress management measures that just beyond or over and above the canals on the surface, we saying what other solutions can be implemented, as well as the monitoring of stream flows needs to be done. On the establishment of and recommendations on the management solutions to manage flooding of mines and decant, what has been achieved to date, we have managed to draw up regional mine closure strategies, because we have found that these mining areas that we are talking about are interconnected underground. And by virtue of them being interconnected, if one mine in a basin or a sub-basin stops pumping, it floods the rest. And there you run a risk of even sterilizing minerals that could be economically viable for some years, thus cutting immediately. You just cut out jobs, economic growth, etc., etc. So we said in areas like the Vest Basin, we need a regional approach to managing these solutions, and this is what the regional mine closure strategy starts talking to, because you find that mining companies have different environmental management programs that are approved by DMR that don't necessarily talk to what happens at the mine next door. So that's the whole point beyond the regional closure strategies. And what we are going to be doing now going forward is to ensure that all these mining companies in those areas align their individual EMPs with the regional mine closure strategies. Ingress management measures have been proposed. We have had an intensive study of the decant process and impacts. We have done an investigation of passive treatment technologies where you treat water where it is. You don't really need to pump it and then treat it, which is a bit cheaper than the active treatment, which involves pumping. Monitoring of water levels and quality. We have constantly monitored the water levels and quality, such that we now know the water levels in the sub-basins, in the Vest Basin. And from that, we have been able to predict when we are expecting to see some decanting happening, as opposed to what has been going on in the media. Like Joburg is going to see a horror movie tomorrow. That is not going to happen. The situation is under control. We know what is happening. We have modeled the underground space. And this is through the work on this research program. But we have also been monitoring seismic activities within that area, because pumping of water, which is one other issue, I think, Chairperson, that we need to constantly talk about so that people get to understand this. It's like pumping is the solution. Pumping also presents its own challenges, where if you pump too much, then you destabilize the ground and you start getting some seismicity. But if water also rises up too much to certain levels, it could also have that effect. So it's a process that needs to be managed very carefully, scientifically, technically, and monitored on an ongoing basis. What remains to be done on this program is the implementation of flooding and decan control measures and the implementation of the regional land closure strategies. With the flooding and decan control measures, really we have identified solutions. For example, we, as it has been said, that there is going to be flooding. Yes, there is going to be flooding, but you have options technically. One, you either allow flooding to happen, but you do what is called controlled decanting. You allow decanting to happen, but you do controlled decanting, where you canalize the water underground, allow it to move towards low-lying areas. For example, we said that we have predicted and we've identified different decant points where we are expecting water to decant at certain points. You then allow water to move towards that direction. Canalize it, allow it to move in that direction. But then at the decant point, that's where you place your control measure in terms of saying you pump it out, treat, how do you then channel it, where, etc., etc. All of those solutions have been worked on and they are in place. The issue now that is being worked on is funding, because this is a very costly exercise. And this, I must say that we are 96% complete with the work that we had to do with the science councils that we are going to be reporting or presenting to the interministerial committee that was set up just to look at the water problems in the Vet Basin. And all these solutions that we are proposing are in that document that we are going to be presenting to the ministers. And depending on the availability of ministers, we are supposed to be presenting to them sometime between this week and next week. But also we need to pilot some of the passive treatment methods that we have identified, as well as, of course, ongoing monitoring, which is very critical, because at some point it becomes a monitoring issue. How do you manage and monitor the solutions going forward? On the development of management options, what has been achieved to date, studies of ingress and decant have identified management options. For example, the construction of canals, controlled decant points, and the assessment of treatment options, including passive treatment methods that we've spoken about. What remains to be done is the assessment, really, of the various options and the implementation and pilot testing, really, the solutions. The prediction, I've spoken to that. We have predicted, after identifying the decant points, we have predicted the times. Our research has showed us that in 18 months, the water would have reached what we refer to as environmental critical levels. ECLs are levels at which we can allow the water to rise without having any problem or disaster. Beyond that level, that's when we need to start implementing solutions. And we know what the different ECLs are in the different sub-basins. And in 30 months from now, that's where we are expecting to see water decanting onto the surface. But that will not be allowed to just happen uncontrolled, because we have identified solutions to deal with that. What remains to be done, really, is the refinement of the predictions as more information becomes available from our research that we are continuing with. The last part of the presentation, Chairperson, looks at the implementation, because when we presented the last time to the committee, we said the department has developed a rehabilitation strategy that talks to how are we going to start rehabilitating the 6,152 sites. And what we have done, we've said we need to look at solutions in the short to medium term. And we have therefore developed a 10-year implementation plan that talks to how are we going to do this. But what we have done looking at the implementation, this graph indicates how long it would take us roughly to do the whole 6,000 sites. And our projections or estimations are saying it would take us to about 2038. And the pink line indicates us starting at 6,000, dropping reducing the number of state liability to zero to 2038. But the blue line also then indicates the effects of inflation on the costs, which then gives you the difference on state liability, which indicates that we could predict the figure or do an estimation or a projection in terms of cost today. But one thing that we need to keep at the back of our minds is the impact of the inflation on the costs for implementing the program. The plan is really a medium to long-term plan review. It would be reviewed on an MTEF basis, and we are saying we would review it towards the end of the 10 years, but also we would look at a continuous update on the technologies that we would use as we implement, but also look at updates on best practices, learning from other international jurisdictions as well. Just briefly, the implementation plan has about three phases. And we are saying in phase one, which is 2010 to 2013, we would be looking at methodological development, for example, looking at a generic rehabilitation manual. Members would appreciate that South Africa mines about 53 commodities, so it won't be possible to have 53 rehabilitation manuals for the different commodities. So we will develop a generic rehabilitation manual, but here and there it would be customized to a specific commodity based on the environmental impacts that it presents. Prioritization of large-scale sites, implementation of projects with greater risks and impact on society and the environment, but we would also be setting up structures for pumping and treatment, and that's at a large scale. At a small scale, we would be implementing passive treatment methods. Moving on to phase two, which is 2013 to 2016, we would be looking at the commencement of the rehabilitation of large-scale sites with medium risks and impacts. Monitoring and evaluation would be in place, because what we are currently doing also is to look at a guideline for monitoring and evaluation. And the development of management technologies where larger programs, for example, pumping and treatment, does not balance the economies of scale, passive treatment designs would have to be looked at. Because this is as a result of, again, the research that we have done. We've looked at, unlike your vet basin, where you have a large area of interconnectedness in the mines, and there you know that you are looking at a large program, a large-scale program for treatment and pumping. In some areas, for example, Mpumalanga, you would find that there are small pockets here and there of acid mine drainage, and it would not balance the economies of scale to set up active treatment plants in those areas, but you would rather opt for smaller passive treatment plants in those areas, which are also cheaper than your large-scale pumping and treatment options. And in our phase three, we are saying we would look at a full-scale rehabilitation and management for those requiring management going forward, the implementation of other management solutions, monitoring and evaluation, as well as evaluation of latent impacts, because we have also seen that some sites might look okay now, only to find that you would start seeing some impacts like 15, 20, 30 years down the line. So we need also at that point to start saying, how do we look at the latent impacts going forward, and how do we provide for them financially now so that we don't run into problems in the future. But we would also review the rehab plan for further long-term implementation, as well as the review of the budget, taking inflation into account. Financial projections on this 10-year implementation plan, we need about 1.4 billion rands for us to implement this program over 10 years. And this is the plan that we are going to be taking to National Treasury to say, if we are to resolve this problem, this is how much we're going to need. The work that we are currently doing on the water management issues in the Vest Basin has shown us that just to set up a medium scale of about 20 million liters of water per day of pumping and treatment, Just to set up a plant of that capacity, we need about 400 million, one plant. So that's where we are financially. And this projection has not considered inflation. And really, most large-scale projects, not just one large-scale project, you're looking at about 130 million rand. So that's the major challenge that we have come across as we started drilling into the detail of what it is that we need exactly to deal with the challenge. In conclusion, Chairperson, really, as we have worked into going into detail with this program, we have realized that it's bigger than we all thought, and it's bigger than what the public generally thinks this is. And really, the creation of this dates back to the 1600s, and that there we're looking at about 349 years of damage. And that can never really be resolved in less than 16 years that this program received attention from government. Because, you know, the minister said a very interesting story with us, where she said with us that when she joined the department as a deputy minister in 1996, there was no unit in the department that looked at environmental management issues in the mines. Even though the Minerals Act was there, there was no unit, and therefore there was no budget. So this program of managing derelict and ownerless mines was never there. And at that point, they had to start then mobilizing National Treasury, firstly just for the unit to be established and the unit to be funded, and then looking at funding the program. And really, the nature of mining is such that some of the impacts will forever be there. The critical question becomes, how do we manage them? And this is really my favorite case study. The Red Spanish River, the Rio Tinto River. There, if you read on that case study, they talk about 5,000 years of mining. Mining happened there 5,000 years ago. But even now, they are still dealing with the challenges of managing acid mine drainage. So this is not unique to South Africa, but the issue is, how do you manage it, how do you fund it going forward? But also considering that the fiscus is faced with competing needs, there is no way that DMR will take this plan and go to National Treasury and we say, in 10 years, over the 10 years, we need 1.7 billion. And then they give, what is 1.7 divided by 10? They give us whatever we need then per year. There is no way we're going to get that from the fiscus. We need then to start looking at alternatives. Investments in management principles and technologies is very critical at this point, and that is something that has never been done, but we are saying we need to start looking at that as well. But also we need really to start a dialogue on the funding options, because the fiscus can never on its own cope with this. This is a big program, and yet there are other bigger programs that the fiscus has to look at. Proper planning is in place. We have started the groundwork. We have started aligning our ducks. All that remains is to say, how do we fund the programs going forward? And that, Chairperson, brings us to the end of the presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Chief Director, sir. Chief Director. Okay. Thank you very much, Chief Directors, for that in-depth presentation. You know, I'm just worried about this derelict and ownerless mines, because with inflation, if you look at it, Honorable St. Clair, then we are talking about not 1.4 billion, we're talking about 4 billion something. Am I right? If you calculate it with inflation. Yeah. And that is over a period of 28 years. So it will escalate basically on a yearly basis. Yeah, estimated cost for a 10-year plan. Honorable members, we've got a challenge in terms of time. The Secretary has made a mistake on the notices, or the notices I've got it in my program that it's the meeting was scheduled till 1. But it says on the notice 10 till 12. Now, I was challenged, IT challenged, because my system was in for repair at Parliament IT, so I could not have opened up any emails or that type of thing. It's either that we've got two choices. We try and go on to 1 and put some questions, or we put some questions in writing to the department, and if needs be, look, make some space in our program to come and deal with the questions after we've got the briefing today. Let me hear from you, members. That's the two options I'm putting on the table. Let me hear from you. Wilson Clay?
Okay, thank you. I think we were bombarded today with a lot of information and facts and figures and so on, and I must thank the department for coming very well prepared. but I, with your permission, I would suggest a third option, specifically regarding the last input and with reference to the mine water and all the hype that's been created around that, that this committee consider doing oversight specifically to the mines that's implicated and the areas that's implicated to get a better understanding of it. I hear the official speaking about, you know, everything being on control, but as you rightly said, when you read in the papers, there's a big crisis there. And in that process, then raise some of the issues or the questions that's been raised here. Regarding the first presentation, naturally one would need a different approach, because I think there's also a lot of issues to be engaged. So essentially, I want to suggest two issues: that we consider doing an oversight visit, but create another opportunity to deal with it. I see the colleagues of the DEA and the ID and so on disappeared. Don't know where they went. Maybe they're trying to find their identity. But let's leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Sekwe. Honourable Nyambi?
Thanks, Chair. I don't know whether to say I'm tempted to support what he's saying, but I strongly feel that we won't be able to do justice in terms of engaging now. And even if we can say we're going to write questions, let's do the oversight and have an opportunity where we'll have them and seriously engage so that we can be able to do justice to all these presentations that has been done. Because you can see that I don't know whether it was a strategy on their part to make it in a way that will not allow us to engage. So when they are going to have an opportunity to come back, they are not going to start afresh. We'll be ready, we'll be prepared, and it will be after the oversight that has been proposed by Honorable Sinclair, and in that way we'll be doing it justice. So that is my submission, Chair.
Honorable Dikhali, then Honorable Nguni.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know from them if ever they don't have time to answer the questions, because it's not yet 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Honorable Nguni, I'll answer you now, Honorable Dikhali.
Chair, I was going to propose that when they come back for the annual report, let's have enough time when they come back for the annual report, because these will form part of the annual report, so that the questions you're supposed to pose today, we pose them during the time of the annual report. Just that you make sure that the Secretary has got enough time for that period for annual report.
Oh, Honorable Khalid, just to answer you, we have scheduled the meeting because we were not sure of Parliament's program. I think the program authority haven't given us a clear indication of the time that we have sent out the invite to the department to come and brief us what our time frame will be. If we knew now what would have happened then, If we knew then what would have happened today, we would have scheduled this for the whole day, up until 4 o'clock. But unfortunately, the powers that be has not indicated to us that, look, you've got the whole day or something. And we have scheduled the meeting till 12:01. We've got still two outstanding agenda points. And I think that will take us then, if we engage with questions beyond 1 o'clock. I would really put it to the committee that in the light of the views expressed by the committee, is that we, in our busy schedule that we have, find the time, even if we, I think one of these mines were in the Free State, was one of these mines in the Free State, are there mines in the Free State? Because we are going for taking Parliament to the people on 15th to 19th of November, and if I look at the program, I'm not sure when are we gonna. Yeah, now I see that there's still the 26th of October. They're coming back with the annual report in terms of our program. So yes, we can do some of the questions on the annual report, and when we do our oversight, because we also need to do the oversight in terms of the mining charter, so that we can kill two birds with one stone. Doing the oversight on the mining charter, and also doing the oversight in terms of the DNOs. And then we can then engage the department again to that on that basis, on that what they have presented, but also as Honourable Gooney said in the annual report, and also when we do the oversight to the DNOs and that the Relic and Ownerless Mines, it's not a new department DNO, so please don't confuse, and also do on the charter, because when we did our oversight initially to one or two of the mines, what we've seen was not what they reported to DMR. It's totally different, totally skewed different from what, you know, paper is very patient. This is one of the most patient things in the world. You can do anything you like to it. It won't fight, it won't come back, it won't cry or anything. So, Chief Directors, our plan of action will be that we will engage you again during the annual report session, but also when we do our oversight, we will engage you again. So, as the member says, it has been really a mouthful. So they will go, we will go and digest what there is to digest, and we will then come up with the technical questions and all that there is. So from our part, we would like to thank you on behalf of the committee. I would like to thank you for your time and effort that you have spent in coming to address this committee. And we will be seeing each other before Christmas.
If I may, Chairperson, we will send through the documents related to the charter, the declaration that was signed by the minister in the industry, the gazetted charter, and the report, the review report of the charter, so that then members could read up front. But also a request from us, Chairperson, based on the comments and questions. We come thoroughly prepared, not that we want to limit you. So that is why we are happy to start at 7 o'clock in the morning and finish at 5 p.m. So if the next engagement is scheduled for 7 to 5, we are game, Chairperson. Thank you.
Oh, we like that, but we'll do that on DMR's campus or at the head of us. Or we'll invite DMR. But in actual fact, when we do our oversight, we will definitely invite you along as well so that we can also engage there. You know, we'll make the... Yeah, we make the platform in Free State. If you can let the secretary still with him this week get those DNOs in the Free State, and we will then write to the chairperson of the council to ask that this committee overtake and oversight for a day or two to this DN, the relic and onerous mines in the Free State. That would really appreciate. So we thank you very much, and we'll keep you at your 7 o'clock, but we'll get to the 7 o'clock to 5 o'clock working agreement. But thank you very much, Chief Directors, all of the best, and spend your time wisely now. I don't want to say go get the 4 billion. Go talk to Treasury and get the 4 billion for the rehabilitation of mines. Members, we come to our second point on the agenda. you are excused if you want to be excused. Before we go to the consideration and adoption of the fourth term report or program? Sorry, fourth term program. I've just got the oversight for, and it's a pity that the Honourable Van Lingen has gone now, because there were some certain issues that I wanted to clear out with the, you know, as certain of our members won't be able to go on this oversight. I'm looking at the Honourable Nyambi. He has just been called to a meeting by the Chief Whip on Thursday morning at 8 o'clock or 7:30. At 7:30 in the morning. So I don't know how quick you can get a flight from PE to be at 7:30. So to take you out of that misery, we will excuse you on that oversight because you have been called by higher powers. The Honourable Nguni will be in Italy by then. And the Honourable Dikgale will be on her way to France by then. So that leaves... who else is going with you from this committee? Just yourself and Honourable Dikgale. Just the two. And... so... that leaves then... Honourable Sinclair has also asked for... to be excused on Friday. That leaves for Thursday then... myself, Honourable Sinclair, and who else is? Mr. Kamede and Honourable Van Lingen. As he excused himself. Uppington. So that leaves us with three members. So that's the reason I wanted to find out from Mrs. Van Lingen if she has already scheduled anything in terms of liaising with the people. Have we sent out official notices to where have we sent official notices? Has the members got this program? Honourable Sinclair says no, he hasn't got. The Eastern Cape. The Eastern Cape one. From the Eastern Cape. They haven't looked at flights after 12 or 1 during the day from PE. Grace? Yeah. I would end the program at 1 or 12 so that members have got, because, I mean, we will be really be very thin and it is not proper for just two members of a committee to go to any, although whether we have to cut out Ngora development and Petro SA proposed. I mean, they haven't even built on that site yet. And that, so, and just stopped at 1, at 12. Yeah. And then we go to the airport. From there, we can get earlier flights. The other thing is, honorable members, honorable from Cliff.
It's really unfortunate that this other colleague is not here, because it seems that Ms. Van Langen is quite instrumental in assisting with the program. But be it as it may, I indicated that I'll only be available till Thursday evening. And it seems to me that, with due respect, we want to chew off more than what we can chew. There's many activities in this program, you know, very busy program and so on. And I would, my approach on this issue is rather to focus on one or two things that you can do and do them good than try and focus on 12 or 13 and you can't, you know, address them. Now, what I remember from the beginning was that Ms. Van Langen had the issue with this issue about Tuispunt and the nuclear proposed facility and so on. And if I look at it, it seems that there's a community stakeholders meeting on Wednesday the 18th, and then there's a visit to Tuispunt, and then there's engagement with the municipality, and then the afternoon there's wind and energy stakeholders affairs. I don't know what does that mean, and then there's some time in the afternoon. So I would really request you to consider that we stop it on Thursday evening. I will be leaving at Thursday evening, and then it only leaves, I think, the Honourable Chairperson and who else? And Honourable. So if you're prepared to continue with three people on Friday, then it's fine, but I will only be available till Thursday evening.
Some of them are coming on the Friday, the members from the province. But you see, my point is, I've got a problem with placement. After engaging with the departments, there is no decision on placement yet. And as far as I'm concerned, it will be a fruitless exercise for us as committee to go to placement. There's no decision on placement. Cabinet has not made a decision on placement. It was a proposed site. There's three proposed sites which NNR, National Nuclear Regulator, has proposed. But it has not even gone to cabinet. There's not even a cabinet committee been appointed to look after this issue of placement. So I would see that, you know, the all the hype that has been created with the Tuispunt issue and all that, and the media hype. I wonder if Tuispunt is really going to add value to our visit. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, the stakeholders had a meeting with NNR. They had a meeting with, and I mean, it's only DOE and the minister that can go there after cabinet has made a decision. I think that placement has been shelved, as far as I'm concerned. So let me hear from the members. Do you think it's viable for us to go to placement? Anyone think?
Yeah, you see, I'm just afraid that if I look at the program, it seems that we're going to walk into a community stakeholders meeting. Yeah, but with very little background in terms of what is this whole story about. And I would suggest that if we have a discussion on Tuispunt, then ESCOM or the department or somebody must brief us on that, you know. But if you tell us that there's no decision, then I honestly don't know, in terms of our oversight role, what we're going to do there. We're going to listen to people, and that's about all, you know. Which then brings me to the point that, you know, I'm just concerned, and I must say that it seems that the Honourable Van Lingen did a lot of work, but I'm just concerned that we're not well prepared, and I don't want to be part of a process that looks like a stooge. Go and sit there, and you don't know what to answer and what to do and this and that and the other. If they want to focus on developmental issues, economic developmental issues like trade and industry and engaging the Kuga municipality and wind energy and so on, I think we would be more prepared to listen to that and build that into our things. But if you want to convince us that Tuispunt is a hot potato at the moment, and we don't have the answers and we're not briefed, then I say no. For now, let's just take it out of the equation. But I know Mrs. Van Lingen won't appreciate what I'm saying, because she's got maybe her own reasons why she's putting it on the agenda. So it's a bit of an unfortunate process.
Honourable Sinclair, this too. Look, we had the NNR, which did we have the national nuclear energy regulator. We had them here. And Honourable Van Lingen was pushing the point of placement. And the presenter was saying that there is no decision. It was only proposals. A proposed site. It's only a proposed site. And the impact studies that were done has found that Tuispunt is the suitable site if NNR wants to go to put up a nuclear station there. But it has been then also been driven to say by the Department of Energy that for now, Kuberg is suffice. If we have followed the trend and the discussions. So I really don't know what, and I tend to agree with Honourable Sinclair that placement, it's not going to serve our purpose on this visit. Specifically also on the Kuga project, you know, the department, the portfolio committee has been to Kuga not longer than 3 months ago. There has been to Petro SA not longer than 3-4 months ago. So, like I said, we spoke about the program, and we haven't really given it a thought, a thorough thought in our committee as such. You see, we've got the yacht building industry at St. Francis. We've got the meeting with energy stakeholders and environmental affairs. Honourable members, you know, I don't know. I seek your guidance, because in my view, I think we should just write to the Eastern Cape Portfolio Committee and say that we are postponing the trip as such until we get proper briefing on what is happening in terms of, look, wind energy is a private thing that's going on with wind energy in the Eastern Cape, and I know that the Department of Energy are doing an environmental and impact study on the wind energy around those areas. The thing that is that we had an invite from Volkswagen, the automotive industry, in terms of 11 billion rand, that government, that economic development government has put forward, which was part of the bailout plan for the automotive and the other industries. I'm not sure whether we should do that. But let me hear from you, Honourable Mguni.
Yes, Chairperson, actually I was about to say, what if we postpone the trip and then we gather all the facts, get all the background info on this day spent, and all other information is that the committee has just been there on Kuga development. And then when you go there, we go on those issues that we already have focused on, and just go there, as Honorable Sinclair said, untreated. And the worst of all, we'll only be three, and the community will say we undermine them. We come there, so the committee just really will pitch up at the end of the day.
Madihani?
I think Ms. Aniel will understand that this trip won't work. I'm seconding the speakers. Got it postponed. Thank you.
Honorable Sinclair, there is a proposal and a second on the table, but let me hear you.
Yeah, Jay, no, I understand that, but on the other hand, a lot of work has been done. I mean, the application has been put in. It has been approved by the authorities here in the NCOP and so on. You know, and I always just pity the officials that go through this process and start booking and making arrangements, and now on 99, it's must cancel again and so on. Now, we work as a collective. I mean, if we three or nine or whatever, the committee will be represented. And I would suggest that in terms of the program, we maybe work here and then panel beat a bit, that we exclude the initiative of Tayspunt for now because of the reality that we don't have all the facts and all the background to that, but that we engage on the other issues, that we engage with the municipality, the Kuga municipality, the industries, and even if you want to continue with the Volkswagen, because government has invested a lot of money in the motor industry. Petro SA, as you indicated, the portfolio committee was there, the same with the development area there. So my plea, and I don't know who's going to support me, usually the Honourable Nambi thinks someone, maybe he will support me, cross the line today and support me. But what I want to plead, in the interest of the organization, of Parliament, let's not, drop the people and say we're not going, even if we're four or five or whatever, we're not going to Italy, we're not going to wherever, I mean, they've got the privilege to go there. But let's go and do the things there in a way that's in the interest of Parliament and the NCOP.
Can I trust the Rojiri Khale withdraw, knowing that what preparation is going into when you go on this trip, but let him withdraw and side with the Honourable Sinclair.
Cross the floor now. Honourable Nambi.
I wanted to say, to support him and say, all those that are confirmed and it's possible to be attended, let them be attended. But in a situation where it's an impossible case and there's no arrangement that has been involved, then it's a different case altogether.
Look, Honourable Van Lingen has put down some telephone numbers, so I'm going to ask the Secretary, request the Secretary to do us a big favour and just confirm with these people what has been confirmed. Find out from Volkswagen if we can reschedule their meeting for Thursday. When everybody's there, Honourable Sinclair is there, and just find out from the I will send Honourable Van Lingen an email now to say that we're going to put placement on the back burner for for time being. We as a committee have decided that it's a pity that she had to leave so early. We're going to put placement on the back burner. But then we engage with maybe the boat, the yacht building industry on Wednesday while we're there. It's not a trenchment for people to just shift their programs around. I don't think it's such a trenchment. And then we meet with the municipality a bit earlier, and after lunch we can meet with Volkswagen, because we're going to meet with Volkswagen an hour and a half, so we can meet with Volkswagen after lunch, and then on Friday morning we can just do the how do you pronounce his name? Ngura? Is it Mocha? Mocha Development. And if it has been, because I don't see anything that it has been, there's no contact person on her list here that she has provided. She has provided with all the other people, but there's no contact on her list here. And meet with the Mocha people and Petro SA earlier, and we finish off at 12. Can we ask the secretary to do that and check earlier flights for those members that has gone back to their respective homes and provinces, please? I mean, look, placement is coming out at the moment. We're not going to engage placements. We're going to engage Nelson Mandela on what? I'm just going to do a courtesy call on the mayor and talk about the low LED, or and do we have to do that? No. But if you can just find out if the thing has been arranged. If not, you know, it really makes it difficult if members have to run off early. And we have said this, you know, I've included this on the program. And then afterwards they just said they need to run. The Honorable Van Dingen could have said, and we could have asked the department for 10 minutes of their time. We could have dealt with this. Time I've put it on the program. And I said, there's the two oversight things. Is that in order then, members? If we do that. Okay, wonderful. Honorable members, then on our program, our draft amended program, if you can just, we will just then write in terms of between the 15th and the 19th when they go and do the oversight to the clinics and schools, we will ask just to go to two or three of the derelict and onerous mines in the Free State with the Department of Mineral Resources. We will write that letter to the NCOP chairperson and chief, and just to ask if we can not go and visit clinics and that type of things, but just go and focus our attention on the work that we do as a committee. Just to give us the sense of how does this derelict ownerless minds look, and so that we can come back and engage the department on that.
No.
Are we going to Paris? No. Honorable Ngudi, which part of the Free State are
you? I think we're going to, Harry Smith. Kwakwa, Putadichava. So it's in Pradichava. It's about 2.5 hours drive to around the mines in Welcome, unless there's a mine. And I don't think of any other mine near Pradichava. The nearest is in Welcome, where we've got other scientific mines, of which it's 2.5 hours drive. Single trip, yeah. Return is going to be 5, yeah. Return trip is going to be 5 hours.
Members, can we, if there's any amendments to the program, we will let you know timely.
Next week, members, the other thing is next week's meeting. It will only be Honourable Gamede, Honourable Sinclair, Honourable Van Lingen. No, Honourable Miami is not here. And Honourable Abrams. Is he going with you? Okay. And Gunda. So, let me just make it clear, because four of us won't be here. Four provinces won't be here. So you are left with five provinces. Free State, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and Western Cape. Other was okay.
Yeah, I suggest that we continue. I suppose we can't make decisions because we actually don't correct. You need six of the nine provinces. So, but I suggest that we can continue these. Other colleagues are clever. They will catch us when we come back.
It will just, what I'm thinking, it will just put the other colleagues when we have to vote on the amendment to the Articles 6 and 16 on the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency Statute. That will be a dilemma for the committee as such, as we won't have the five provinces. The six provinces required. That will really put the spanner in the works. Honourable Khari?
Chairperson, I think I differ with Honourable Member. Because the other one will be chairing, and then four will be attending, and then if you vote, then the ANC will.
I hear what you say, but you know, it's look, there is a briefing also on the Department of Energy on the amendments to the articles, the statute. I think the NA has dealt with that just before the recess period. The NA has dealt with that. On the IAEA, it's just the NCOP that needs to deal with it for this statute because it considers two houses of parliament. The 2 hours to deal with all statutes and that. So there won't be enough provinces to vote on this. Honourable Mguni?
Can you postpone it to the next week? The following week?
Well, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. We can do that. Or if needs be, we can ask the I haven't got a parliamentary. Has anyone got a parliamentary program? If there is no sitting on the 26th of October, the afternoon, we can ask the chief whip if we can then get that slot on the 26th, the afternoon of the 26th, and slot it in there. And then the colleagues can go on with the briefing by the Department of Energy and the strategy and the rollout of the solar water heater geysers. Can we do that then, please? We write to the department to say that we're going to be a quorum to vote on this, but we will definitely slot them in on the 26th. As Manuel Resources confirmed that they will come and brief us on the geosciences amendment bill? Okay. Have they confirmed that? Okay. And also on the annual report. It's a Section 75 bill. Can't we conclude the bill by then also? Because, I mean, the bill doesn't have to go to provinces and all that. That's Section 76. But But can we adopt? Oh, we can't, because we are not six provinces.
Okay. But...